Chapter 9. The Economy Size War. My plane from Madrid landed at Dulles Airport mid-afternoon on Sunday, August 24th. I had found an unoccupied row of seats and worked on my notes for the entire flight, breaking only to eat and to listen to a monologue from a USAID officer I had known in Abidjan. Normally, a case officer would never carry sensitive notes on an international flight. In fact, agency regulations strictly forbade it. Too much risk of skyjacking, kidnapping, or search by an aggressive customs officer. But I had been faced with a dilemma common to case officers in high-priority operations. Pouch time from Kinshasa to headquarters was 3 weeks, and I would be required to report in detail the day after my return. So I did what most case officers do. I took a chance and stuffed the notes in my pocket. Once on board the Dulles flight, I worried less. Barring a skyjacking to Cuba or a mugging in Washington, I was home free. My diplomatic passport would grease the way through U.S. Customs and Immigration. My bags would not be opened. Monday, August 25th, I briefed Potts at the morning staff meeting, fleshing out my cabled report about the FNLA and describing UNITA. Bantam told me to stand by to brief the director and the 40 committee, but Potts scotched that, relaying the gist of my findings up the ladder without taking me along. This was consistent with his tendency to keep that level of activity to himself, and I probably encouraged his caution anyway when I confronted him in his office immediately after the staff meeting. Potts and I had never analyzed the Angola program together. Now that I was confident of my knowledge of Angola, I wanted to have an airing, to hear his rationale for the program, and to make some basic suggestions. He had all along discouraged this kind of questioning in the staff meetings, and I hoped to be more successful in the privacy of his office. It didn't work. Potts refused to respond, and the meeting became a Stockwell monologue which went something like this. We had two viable options in Angola. We could give the FNLA and UNITA enough support to win. By going in quickly with tactical air support and advisors, we could take Luanda and put the MPLA out of business before the Soviets could react. Otherwise, if we weren't willing to do that, we would further U.S. interests by staying out of the conflict. The middle ground, feeling our way along with small amounts of aid, would only escalate the war and get the United States far out on a fragile limb. It would help neither the Angolan people nor us. To the contrary, it would jeopardize the United States' position in southern Africa. Potts wanted none of it. In his best patronizing manner, he averred that I would, with more experience, find these situations difficult. Clear solutions rarely presented themselves. Our program would no doubt be a compromise between my alternatives. He broke off the conversation. On the way into the working group session Thursday morning, August 28th, however, he reinforced the point. Just stick to the facts about your trip, he said. Don't make any conclusions or recommendations. Possibly Potts would have been happier without me along, but that would have been awkward. The working group knew of my trip and was eager to hear the report firsthand. Working group meetings were held in the DDO's spare conference room off C corridor on the third floor. Paneled and carpeted, with a huge oak conference table, this chamber was more attractive than Africa Division's utilitarian offices, though still confining. There were no windows and ventilation was poor. On a back wall hung pictures of some of the agency's previous deputy directors of operations. Potts sat at the head of the table, with the former ambassador to Zaire, Sheldon Vance, representing the Secretary of State's office on his right, and Hal Horan, the National Security Council senior staff member, on his left. Other members ranged down the table. The Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Joseph Sisko himself never attended, but was always represented by a senior staffer. The Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, also represented by a senior staffer. Edward Mulcahy, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Lieutenant General Howard Fish, Director of the Defense Security Assistance Agency. The Director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, INR, represented by Francis Dittar. Colonel Clinton Granger, Director of the Planning Staff, National Security Council. Rear Admiral Samuel Packer, Assistant Deputy Director for Political Military Affairs. Colonel Gene Rawlings, Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Director of the Office of Central African Affairs of the Defense Department. And Walt Cutler, Director of the Office of Central African Affairs of the State Department. Potts was chairman, representing the CIA director. Various Africa Division senior officers, including, of course, myself, always attended. Footnote. The 40 Committee, National Security Council mechanism, traditionally directs covert wars, assassination attempts, and coups in other countries. Because of doubts raised by Watergate and the Church Committee disclosures, the working group was appointed to provide closer supervision of the CIA. From 1969 to 1976, the National Security Council was dominated by Henry Kissinger, who often dispensed with its services altogether, giving his orders directly to the CIA. The CIA has used 40 Committee approval to authenticate some of its more sensitive operations, but has by no means brought all of its covert actions to the attention of the 40 Committee. The Pike Committee, House Select Committee on Intelligence, made a serious error when it concluded in its January 1976 report that the CIA was remarkably responsive to the controls of the National Security Council, NSC, and that all major covert action projects had had presidential approval. William Corson concludes rather that, quote, "It is important to remember that 75% to 85% of all covert operations and activities carried out during that period, 1947 to 1952, were never really reviewed by any organization or body outside of the group, agency, or service which initiated them." End quote. Armies of Ignorance, William R. Corson, New York Dial, 1977, page 350. Without true confessions from the operatives involved, it would be impossible to estimate the percentage of operations throughout the years which have been run without NSC supervision. But certainly they were numerous, and some of major consequence. The Pike Committee was forced to rely on the testimony of reluctant witnesses and on documents the CIA selectively provided, which doubtless indicated complete fidelity to NSC direction. However, what the Pike Committee was unable to penetrate was the gray area of CIA operations, where its operatives take action without leaving written traces of what they do. For example, the CIA station in Ghana played a major role in the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah in 1966, in violation of a 40 Committee decision not to. But CIA cables and dispatches infer that all contacts with the plotters were undertaken solely to obtain intelligence on what they were doing. Similarly, CIA written records become mysteriously vague about the Lumumba assassination plot, the Trujillo assassination plot, and the Schneider assassination plot. In each case, there are documents which place CIA officers in supportive contact with the eventual assassins, but the link seems to break before the final deed. End footnote. I stood in a corner of the crowded room beside the large map of Angola. Red, green, and blue stick-ons indicated areas held by the MPLA, FNLA, and UNITA. Sweeping red and green arrows showed advances, and jagged bomb bursts marked clashes. Little figures had been traced from Mad Magazine's Spy vs. Spy series, cut from black plastic and stuck to the board to indicate the places I had visited. Using a pointer, I led the group through my trip, giving vignettes and describing personalities, as well as presenting facts and military assessments. I avoided mentioning agency officers by name, or any of the foreigners I had encountered who might eventually be recruited to work for the agency. Remembering Potts's admonition, I stuck to the trip and to the facts I had assembled. I made it clear that, despite disorganization and inefficiency, our allies seemed determined to fight and were apparently equal to the MPLA forces in numbers and effectiveness. I restrained myself from saying that if we gave them abundant immediate support, they had a chance of winning the civil war, and that otherwise I felt we should withdraw altogether. Potts appeared relaxed. Then I nearly gummed up the works, simply by saying, "We," when I reported going to Silva Porto. Potts blanched, and a branch chief who was sitting nearby began shaking his head at me. I muddled on, and only later learned what was so wrong with "we." I had meant myself and my interpreter, a Portuguese-speaking case officer who had just completed a mission in MPLA-held Luanda, under official State Department cover. The State Department would never have approved his subsequent appearance on the other side of the lines, in Silva Porto, so the CIA had lied to the working group about it. This sort of deceit was common enough, but they had forgotten to mention it to me. Unwittingly, I had nearly exposed the lie. When I was done, Frank Wisner from the office of the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs fixed me with a stare and asked bluntly what we hoped to accomplish in Angola. Although Frank was a State Department Foreign Service officer, his father had been CIA, rising to the position of Chief of the Office of Policy Coordination, which in 1950 was the original clandestine services. By coincidence, his father's picture hung on the wall behind him, the resemblance clear enough, the father's bald pate exaggerating Frank's own premature acomia. Wisner's question presented a good opportunity for me to relinquish the floor. "Well, Frank," I said, "Mr. Potts was addressing exactly that question earlier today. If you don't mind, I would like to defer to him." I turned to Potts. "Sir?" Potts sat forward, pleased to regain control of the meeting. He spoke in bureaucratese. "Our assessment is that we can provide the wherewithal to prop up the FNLA and UNITA so they can hold against the MPLA, at least until November 11th. We can't really project beyond that date, but if they do go into independence on an equal footing, we should have various options still open. Perhaps a negotiated settlement could be reached. Perhaps the Soviets and the MPLA will compromise when they see our determination." It was as plausible an explanation of a no-win policy as would ever be given. An hour later, the general nodded and looked at his watch. Others stirred. It was well after 12 o'clock, and Potts was hosting the ambassadors at lunch in the executive dining room. He reached for my arm and said, "John, do come with us." Such are the rewards of a good team player in the CIA. During September and October, the CIA, with remarkable support from diverse U.S. government and military offices around the world, mounted the controversial, economy-size war with single-minded ruthlessness. The lumbering U.S. Air Force C-141 jet transports continued to lift 25-ton loads of obsolete U.S. or untraceable foreign weapons from Charleston, South Carolina, to Kinshasa, where smaller planes took them into Angola. The U.S. Navy, American champion, sailed from Charleston on August 30th with a cargo of arms and equipment. Any snags were handled by a phone call from the CIA to the White House, Pentagon, or State Department, and the problem magically disappeared. CIA officers, eventually 83 altogether, were dispatched to the field, where they beefed up the Kinshasa, Luanda, Lusaka, and Pretoria stations, and manage the air, ground, maritime, and propaganda branches of the little war. An additional $10.7 million, authorized by the President on August 20, 1975, for the purchase of more arms, ammunition, and advisors for Angola, had brought our total budget to $24.7 million. The deadline was November 11, 1975, when the Portuguese would relinquish proprietorship of the colony to whichever movement controlled the capital at that time. The war was a seesaw of escalation. Momentum moved from side to side as the United States and Soviet Union delivered obsolete weapons, then foreign troops, and eventually sophisticated systems such as wire-guided rockets and late-model jet fighter bombers. In early September, the MPLA committed a devastating, ageless weapon, the Russian 122-millimeter rocket, and set the FNLA troops running until the MPLA swept back through Cajito, where I had been, and very nearly to Ambriz. Supplied by the Soviet Union, the 122-millimeter rocket, as much as any one thing, eventually decided the outcome of the civil war in Angola. The working group puzzled over this rocket, unable to grasp its effectiveness against the FNLA in Angola. On paper, it appeared to be an inaccurate pre-World War II rocket, only slightly larger than the 120mm and 4.2-inch mortars we had given the FNLA. Originally designed as a siege weapon of only general accuracy, it had been used by the Viet Cong to harass GVN-held cities in South Vietnam. Two men could carry it through the jungle, fire it from a tripod of crossed sticks, and flee empty-handed. In Angola, its accuracy and volume of fire were increased by the use of truck-mounted launchers, called Stalin organs. I interrupted the working group discussion to tell them about this weapon, remembering the months in Tay Ninh when we were shelled almost daily with 122mm rockets. Think of the loudest clap of thunder you have ever heard, and you won't be close to the 122. If one lands within 100 yards, light fixtures drop from the ceiling and doors jump open. The percussion charge will shatter a small house or penetrate an 18-inch reinforced concrete bunker. The anti-personnel charge fragments into 14,000 red-hot, razor-sharp slivers of steel. Such rockets, landing anywhere near our FNLA troops, would destroy their morale. The 122 had a simple advantage over the weapons we had given the FNLA, namely, range. It would fire 12 kilometers, our mortars no more than 8. From a safe distance, the MPLA could lob 122mm rockets onto FNLA troops who were unable to return fire. Well-organized troops could endure such shelling indefinitely, by digging in or by aggressive patrolling and maneuvering. The 122 could also be neutralized by coordinated artillery fire, tactical aircraft, or electronically guided rocketry, but these were not available to the FNLA. The United States had no simple weapon comparable to the 122 to give the FNLA. Our weaponry jumped from the less effective mortars to heavy artillery and modern rockets. These and tactical aircraft could have neutralized the 122, but they were prohibitively expensive and required highly trained crews to operate them. They would also have been conspicuously American, and the 40 Committee refused to authorize their use. Until December, when it was too late. The answer seemed to come from Zaire and South Africa. On September 11th, Mobutu committed his elite 7th and 4th Commando battalions, flying them to Ambriz in his C-130s, and the tide swung back in favor of the FNLA north of Luanda. On September 17th, a consolidated task force of Zairean, FNLA, and Portuguese troops retook Cajito. Then they began a cautious advance on Luanda itself. Another Zairean force joined a Cabinden liberation force called FLEC, Front for the Liberation of the Enclave of Cabinda, and plunged across the Zairean Cabinda border. Footnote: Cabinda was a curiosity, a small 2,800 square mile area of 60,000 people. It came into being in 1898. When the Cabindan tribal chief had signed the Simbuluku Treaty with the Portuguese, accepting their protection in order to escape the dread forced labor policies of King Leopold of Belgium. The Cabindan people related loosely to the Zaireans of the Lower Congo River, at least more than to the Mbundu of central Angola. End footnote. Cabinda, separated from the rest of Angola by a narrow strip of Zairean territory, had been coveted by the expansionist Mobutu since his ascension to power in the mid-60s. Mobutu's greed was further stimulated in the late-60s, when oil was discovered off the Cabindan coastline. Seeing his chance in October 1975 to annex the MPLA-held Cabinda, Mobutu approached the CIA. "We promptly flew in a 1,000-man arms package for use in the invasion," and CIA officers of the Kinshasa station began to visit the FLEC training camp to coordinate. On November 2nd, a joint invasion force launched a three-column attack against the MPLA defenders, who were reinforced with Cuban advisors. They were accompanied by a half-dozen French mercenaries. Not that they made any difference. Footnote: these Frenchmen may, in fact, have been hired by the French intelligence service, French agents were appearing in Kinshasa and in Angola, but CIA intelligence on the subject was sketchy. End footnote. The Cuban MPLA force easily held Cabinda. Meanwhile, in the central regions of Angola, UNITA was having a difficult time with major action on two flanks. The Katangis checked them at Luso, and a Cuban-led MPLA force turned them back short of Lobito, and then pressed inland from the coast, getting close enough to Nova Lisboa to cut off the city's water and electricity. Reeling, attacked on two sides, Savimbi accepted increasing South African military assistance. He was under enormous pressure from President Kaunda of Zambia to open the Benguela Railroad before November 11th. If Savimbi controlled the railroad by Independence Day, Kaunda could rationalize continued support, perhaps even recognition. Otherwise, Kaunda would have to deal with the MPLA. While Mobutu's commandos were attacking Kahito, a South African armored column crossed the border into southern Angola and began moving north. 50 armored cars were manned by 250 South African soldiers and supported by 750 command, artillery, and logistical troops inside Angola. Another 2,000 troops provided logistical support from the border. C-130s and trucks kept the armored cars fueled, and the commanders got about in light planes and helicopters. The armored cars linked up with 1,000 UNITA soldiers and swept rapidly through much larger Cuban and MPLA forces, even coping with rockets, tanks, light aircraft, and long-range artillery. On October 28th, the South African column captured Mokomedes on the southern coast. By November 7th, they had taken Benguela and Lobito and were pressing north. Another column drove the Katangis out of Luso and moved toward Tejera da Sousa on the eastern border, the last railroad post held by the MPLA. On November 8th, 3 days before independence, the FNLA Zairean column began its advance on Luanda itself, crossing the Kifangando Plain 20 kilometers from the outskirts of the city. They were supported by 4 5.5-inch artillery pieces, which were supplied and manned by the South Africans, and by 2 130-millimeter long-barreled field guns manned by Zairians, which Mobutu had gotten from North Korea. The 5.5-inch pieces were obsolete weapons with limited range, but the 130s could reach 30 kilometers and bring Luanda itself under fire. In the last days before the November 11th independence ceremonies, the Portuguese High Commissioner prepared to depart. The remaining Portuguese colonial troops withdrew to the 16th century San Miguel Fort in Luanda, lining up to photograph each other beside the statue of Prince Henry the Navigator. Outside of Luanda, the MPLA now had control of only 3 of the 15 provinces, a narrow corridor from the coast inland. All sources in Luanda were reporting that the MPLA leaders were terrified and were sending their families out of the country by any means available. The chief of station, Lusaka, cabled headquarters, predicting the MPLA's back would be broken in a few days. The American consul general in Luanda nervously insisted on closing the consulate and was permitted to do so by the State Department, which feared for any American official's safety if the battle came into Luanda itself. The American consular staff departed Luanda November 3rd on one of the last of the refugee evacuation flights. Footnote. The United States had contributed 4 jetliners to a $6 million Red Cross program, which evacuated approximately 300,000 Portuguese Angolan refugees in September and October 1975. End footnote. Between Cajito and Luanda itself, a few dozen Cubans and a frightened MPLA force were preparing their defense and stockpiling the 122-millimeter rockets, which had served them so well in September. In Washington, the CIA advised the working group that the high-water mark had been reached. Without a substantial escalation of commitment, including large amounts of money for arms, tactical aircraft, anti-tank weapons, anti-aircraft rockets, and larger numbers of advisors, the outcome would favor the MPLA. Working group members could not understand this assessment and suggested that it was a CIA ploy to get more money. After my return from Angola in late August, the Headquarters Angola Task Force quickly reached full strength, with a paramilitary section, an intelligence gathering section, a propaganda section, a report section, and a supporting staff of secretaries and assistants. By working extra hours, we were able to avoid going to 24-hour shifts, but the workload was staggering and the pace frantic. For example, on September 4th alone, my notes refer to 63 activities of importance. Things like, write a paper on Kissinger's meeting with the Zairean foreign minister, analyze a David Ottaway article in the Washington Post about American involvement in Angola, discuss UNITA representatives in New York, funded by the CIA, who were meeting with American journalists, attend a working group meeting, attend a personnel management committee meeting, and prepare instructions for a task force officer to hand carry to Kinshasa things too sensitive to be put in writing in the cable traffic. Footnote. Much CIA business is communicated to and from the field by the back channel, hand-carried notes, pouched single copy, official informal letters, and verbal messages. This is consciously done to minimize the number of people inside the CIA who know of a given operation or situation, and to communicate ultra-sensitive messages without leaving a written record. One example. In 1972, the CIA station in Nairobi included a black communicator who would routinely see all of the station cable traffic. That traffic included highly sensitive messages about a Nairobi Dar es Salaam operation in which black Americans traveling in East Africa were surveyed by outside agents and through the Kenyan Security Service. It was felt by the Nairobi chief of station that the black CIA communicator could not be trusted with the knowledge of this operation, and his urgent replacement by a white was necessary. The COS was not about to put that in writing, however, not even in an official informal letter. Instead, he returned to headquarters on consultations and quietly arranged for the young man's transfer. Seymour Hersh of the New York Times exposed the CIA's operation against American blacks on March 17, 1978. End footnote. Among other messages, the officer was to instruct the chief of station, Kinshasa, to ask Larry Devlin to intercede with Mobutu to release the CIA agents, Zairean citizens, Mobutu had arrested, convicted of espionage and treason, and sentenced to death in June 1975. It was embarrassing to the CIA to have these men sitting on death row in Kinshasa while we were hustling Mobutu's Angola war. In late September, Larry Devlin returned to Washington to testify to the Church Committee about the CIA's Congo program of the 1960s and role in the plot to assassinate Lumumba. Of course, he visited CIA headquarters to confer with Potts and with the Congo Task Force, which was responding to the Senate investigation. It hadn't taken me long to realize that Potts didn't want a verbatim transcript of any of the working group meetings. He was staying late after each session to write a summary of what had happened. This didn't seem appropriate, considering his grade and workload. I offered to write up my own notes. When that didn't seem to satisfy him, I suggested we get a professional stenographer who could take shorthand. He agreed, then changed his mind. I dropped it when I finally realized that he wanted to control the exact wording of the record of those meetings. He continued to write the reports, and he did them in the form of blind memoranda, without headings or addressees, and kept them out of CIA official files. Thus, the innermost records of the war would forever be immune to any Freedom of Information Act disclosures or congressional investigation. Technically, they did not exist. Legally, they could be destroyed at any time. The meetings were also supplemented by a steady flow of working group papers, 162 altogether, most of which Potts himself wrote, to brief the members on developments in the field or to document some plan of action. These were either presented to the working group during the meetings or were delivered to them by courier. They, too, were kept in soft files in Potts's desk, where they were safe from disclosure or investigation. In the working group meetings, Potts wanted to speak exclusively for the CIA, and I generally obliged by remaining silent. However, one occasion when I felt compelled to speak out was in early October, when the arrival of a few hundred Cuban soldiers in Angola was being discussed. The working group was thinking of replying with another Zairean battalion, a few dozen mercenaries, and some red-eye missiles. So far, it had been a gentleman's war, with modest escalations and no surprises. During the summer of 1975, 260 Cuban advisors had joined the MPLA, but their presence had scarcely been felt. Now, however, the Cuban ship Vietnam Heroica had delivered 700 uniformed, regular army Cuban soldiers to Puerto Amboim, south of Luanda. The working group tended to view this as a worrisome escalation, but not one which seriously disrupted the quiet evolution of the war. "Gentlemen," I interrupted, leaning forward, "I suggest we think in terms of 10,000 to 15,000 Cuban soldiers, a squadron of MiGs, and 100 or so tanks." Silence fell while they considered the magnitude of such a force. It could march on Kinshasa virtually unopposed. The MiGs would have no problem strafing Mobutu's palace or knocking out the Inga Dam, which supplied electricity to the entire lower Zaire area. However, such a threat and the escalation that would be necessary to neutralize it were too big for this group to handle, and the discussion resumed at the level of a few mercenaries, with perhaps a dozen ground-to-air rockets thrown in for good measure. As the meeting broke up, one participant asked me if the CIA had any special information that large numbers of Cubans might be brought into the conflict. Others turned their heads, listening with interest. We didn't. It wasn't a matter of hard information, special intelligence, or a formal warning from the analysts of the Deputy Directorate of Information. But it was obvious nevertheless. We had introduced the Zairean battalions and the South Africans, and our side had momentum. But the Soviets had mounted a highly visible program in Angola, which was already larger than ours, and their prestige was at stake. And the Cubans had publicly stated their intention to intervene. It was illogical to hope that they would permit the U.S. a cheap victory. This wasn't the 1961 missile crisis in Cuba, where our president could react with great bravado and domestic support. It was Angola, a mere 5 months after the fall of Vietnam. Moreover, the Cuban policy in Angola was consistent with Cuba's ideology and its international stance. Our Angola program, like the previous Bay of Pigs and Operation Mongoose War against Castro, was a direct contradiction of our public policies, making it essential that we keep the American public from knowing the truth. Footnote. In an essay, Intelligence, the Constitution Betrayed, New York Review, September 30, 1976, Henry Steele Cumminger states, quote, "The fact is that the primary function of governmental secrecy in our time has not been to protect the nation against external enemies, but to deny to the American people information essential to the functioning of democracy, to the Congress, information essential to the functioning of the legislative branch, and, at times, to the president himself, information which he should have to conduct his office." End quote. The Church Committee concluded, quote, "Recent presidents have justified secrecy on the basis of national security, the requirements of national defense, or the confidentiality required by sensitive, ongoing negotiations or operations." The Bay of Pigs fiasco, the secret war in Laos, the secret bombing of Cambodia, the anti-Allende activities in Chile, the Watergate affair, were all instances of the use of power cloaked in secrecy, which, when revealed, provoked widespread popular disapproval. End quote. Senate Select Committee Report, April 26, 1976, page 12. End footnote. The Cubans weren't ashamed of their program, and they didn't need to hide it from their own people or from the world press. In fact, on October 8th, the Cuban ambassador to the United Nations, Ricardo Alarcón de Quesada, had announced Cuba's position in a public speech before the General Assembly. Quote, "In Angola, the conspiracy of imperialism, its allies and lackeys, has found concrete expression in the brazen interference designed to frustrate true decolonialization while threatening its territorial integrity, snatching away from the People's Liberation Movement of Angola the fruits of its dauntless struggle against colonialism, while condemning the future state to control by transnational corporations. Cuba renews the expression of its full solidarity with the People's Liberation Movement in Angola. Yesterday heroic in its struggle against the European colonizer, today firm in its defense of true independence. In the face of scandalous interference of imperialists, colonialists, and racists in Angola, it is an elementary duty for Cuba to offer the Angolan people the effective assistance that may be required for that country to ensure its true independence and full sovereignty. In order to spur the decolonization process, a coherent strategy must be implemented with the participation of all progressive forces. This strategy is essential in order to face up to colonialists and racist machinations against the people of Namibia and Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, and must oppose colonialism in all its forms and manifestations in every corner of the earth. End quote. Alarcon's speech was more than polemics. After the war, we learned that Cuba had not been ordered into action by the Soviet Union. To the contrary, the Cuban leaders felt compelled to intervene for their own ideological reasons. We, on the other hand, were fettered by our secrecy and by the fact that our program would be judged wrong by the American people if they learned of it. When Savimbi began capturing Cuban prisoners, we interrogated them in Silva Porto, unable to take them even to Kinshasa for display to prove the Cuban presence in Angola. When the FNLA captured a Soviet-built armored car, we promptly flew it to Kinshasa for an FNLA-sponsored press conference. The Soviet chargé d'affaires angrily called on Mobutu, and he in turn ordered a halt to the press conference. He wasn't exactly afraid of the Soviets, but he didn't really want to advertise Zaire's involvement in Angola, he said. By comparison, when the MPLA captured two South African soldiers, it promptly flew them to Lagos, Nigeria, and then to Addis Ababa for display before the Organization of African Unity. All during the fall months, our secret little drama of Angola was played before a splashy backdrop of disclosures made by the Church Committee. The former Deputy Director of Plans, Operations, Richard Bissell, testified that feasibility studies of how to assassinate Patrice Lumumba had been made in 1961. Sid Gottlieb, the CIA chief of the Office of Technical Services, had hand-carried poison to Kinshasa for the Lumumba operation. Gottlieb himself testified that years later, the CIA director, Richard Helms, had ordered him to destroy all records of the tests he had run of specific poisons to be used in killing Lumumba. The CIA's Chile operation was further exposed. Its relationship with the Chileans who killed General Schneider was admitted. Under intense pressure, Colby disclosed CIA control of large supplies of deadly poison gases, which President Nixon had ordered destroyed some months earlier. Director Colby also testified about the CIA's development of exotic weapons. The press was permitted to photograph Colby, showing the committee an electric pistol, which fired dissolving poison pellets. The agency also admitted, in a more bizarre vein, that it had conducted drug experiments on hundreds of unwitting American citizens by hiring prostitutes to lure them into apartments, feed them drugs, and seduce them, so their activities could be filmed secretly for later viewing by pseudo-scientists of the CIA's Office of Technical Services. We inside the agency reacted to these disclosures differently. The hard core was untroubled by their substance. "Are you kidding?" they would say. "Maybe we could straighten things out if the director had the balls to let us do more of that. After all, the other side..." Others felt betrayed by the CIA directors who had led the CIA into such activities, and by the changing rules which in one decade had us as super patriots, and in another suggested we were enemies of the people. But as the CIA's public image slipped, even the hardest cases felt insecure. If we were still the good guys, the elite of the American Foreign Service, we ourselves seemed to be the only ones who appreciated the fact. We drew closer into our little world, working with agency people, playing tennis with agency people, socializing with agency people. It was not a happy time to conduct a clandestine war. Director Colby, always the good soldier, nevertheless continued to hammer away at the Senate and Congress with a barrage of secret briefings about the Angola program. Our function was to keep him supplied with charts, maps, and debriefing boards, which were updated almost to the hour, with figures reflecting the latest adjustment of the IA feature budget and revised listings of all the arms which had been sent to Kinshasa. We were never told exactly how he used the material, and it still hadn't entered my mind that Colby might be deceiving the senators in any significant way, while they were distracted by his dramatic disclosures of other historic agency malversations. It probably didn't occur to the senators either. Potts rarely gossiped, although he would occasionally give us little insights of how the briefings went, if he thought they were important for us to know. One day, Kissinger smiled at Colby. Colby returned to tell Potts about it, and Potts repeated it to us in his staff meeting, then instructed me to tell the task force. He also told his secretary to spread it around. It was, Potts felt sure, a favorable judgment of our early efforts that Kissinger had smiled at Colby during a National Security Council meeting. Everyone agreed. The incident led me to reflect at length on Kissinger and Colby, who had to be, if anyone was, the master chess players in the game of American intelligence. I often told myself there must be some master plan behind our intelligence policy, someone who saw the effect today's operations would have on tomorrow's world. As a young officer, I had thought of the division chief in those terms. Presuming that everything he did, even some inane, drunken instruction that I learn an obscure African dialect, must be part of the plan, rather the way it worked in Le Carré or Fleming's novels. Footnote. British spy novels represent their intelligence organizations as being directed by a faceless genius, who, from an easy chair in his gentleman's club, gives a studied order which launches operations that move across continents for months until a planned confrontation occurs and the desired objective is achieved, none of which is fully understood by the chain of operatives involved. Only M knows from the outset, like Bobby Fischer launching a 15-move gambit, what the true objective is and how it will materialize out of the chaos of the operation itself in the final drama. This is the unreality, the fiction of British fiction, which separates their novels from the bureaucratic realities of the modern intelligence business. CIA officers escape into The Spy Who Came In From the Cold with the same enthusiasm as the average reader. That's the way the intelligence business should be. However, not all British spy novels are appreciated by the CIA. I was once quietly reprimanded by the senior instructor down at the farm when I recommended that all student case officers be required to read The Looking Glass War. Its story was too close to real life, a pointless little operation run solely because an Army intelligence unit remembered it still had a World War II charter to run agent operations. The agent ignominiously dies, but in the final pages the intelligence chiefs walk away, blithely planning their next operation. After all, they still have their charter, don't they? End footnote. Now I could see that Potts wasn't M, and Colby clearly wasn't either. He was only a disciplined, amoral bureaucrat who fawned over the politicians and game players on the Hill. Kissinger was half genius, perhaps, and half clown. He appeared to be the mastermind, but consider his Angolan policy. Bobby Fischer would never have blundered the Angolan pawn, even if his mind were focused on the queens and rooks of our rivalry with the Soviets. Even Shirley Temple Black, the ambassador to Ghana, had some useful thoughts on the subject. In October 1975, she returned to Washington on consultations and had lunch in the CIA executive dining room after meeting with the director. Carl attended the luncheon and returned impressed. "That's a lot of woman," he said. Carl told us she had complained that no one seemed to be coordinating America's overall policy in African affairs. No one was considering what the Angolan program might do to our relations with Ghana or other countries like Nigeria and Tanzania. She pointed out that the Soviets' national sport is chess, and their foreign policy reflects an effort at long-range planning of coordinated, integrated moves, although they often play the game badly and are given to serious blunders. The Chinese are notorious for planning their foreign policy carefully, with moves designed to reach fruition even years beyond the lifetimes of present leaders. By contrast, Ambassador Black observed, the United States is a poker player. It looks the world over, picks up whatever cards it is dealt, and plays, raising the stakes as more cards are dealt, until the hand is won or lost. Then, after a drag on the cigarette and another sip of whiskey, it looks around for the next hand to be played. Still, if survival was the name of the game, the CIA was not doing badly in the fall of 1975. Not even the Pike Committee had much effect, as Potts enjoyed reporting after accompanying Colby to a committee hearing. Congressman Pike had proposed to open an investigation of IA feature, only to relent when they told him it would be disastrous to have hearings during an ongoing operation. Better not jiggle the hand of the surgeon during an operation, they had said. Potts and Colby had been pleased with themselves, and with the metaphor, jiggle the hand of the surgeon. Potts went about repeating it for several days.